Hello, everybody, and thank you for joining us today. We're going to talk a little bit about some of the challenges that have come through with COVID-19, especially related to HR staffing issues. This is Mandy Smith. I'm the Regulatory Director with Ohio Healthcare Association, and I appreciate everybody calling in today. With that said, we're going to turn the call over to our legal partner, Rolf Goffman, Martin & Lang, and their attorney, Rob Pavanka. So thank you, Rob, for joining us.
Thank you, Mandy. Just make sure you let me know you can hear me.
Yes, I can hear you great.
Okay, great. I didn't want to speak into a black hole and have no one hear me. Good afternoon, everyone. Thank you for joining the call. As OHCA Council, we at Rolf welcome this opportunity to help with this really important information to the long-term care and services community, and are glad to be able to offer information. OHCA is providing this information, obviously, as a public service, free of charge for members and for others in the community, and we're happy that they're doing that and to be able to help. As everyone obviously understands, information and the situation right now is extremely fluid. Recommendations and advice and guidance is changing frequently, sometimes as often as daily, sometimes, frankly, even more often than that. So please do understand that the practices and the guidance that we discussed today is based upon the information and what we understand today. We also have prepared some frequently asked questions that are available on our website. Let me give you that real quickly, because I'm going to be essentially following through this information. It can be found at rolflaw.com/COVID-employment. So the information that I'm going to be talking about can be found there. We encourage you to go take a look at that either while I talk or afterwards. And also, just so you all know, this is being recorded by OHCA and will be available shortly this afternoon. But so, you know, the situation is fluid, and we understand people, you're on this call this afternoon because you want information, and we're going to do the best that we can to provide you information, but just understand that things are changing and advice is changing, and in many cases there simply isn't any clear and definitive guidance on some of the questions that we all have. So we'll do the best that we can and provide what we have now. The information in this call isn't legal advice, and OHCA and Rolf would strongly encourage you to recommend you take consult with your counsel before you take any action. We did receive some questions through Mandy. I believe that many or most of them are going to be addressed by this. May touch on some others that aren't in the materials yet a little bit, but we'll try to cover it. So without any further introduction, we'll move on. And I formatted the materials that are at that website in a Q&A format, and I'm just going to kind of go through those and use those to guide the conversation. So we'll start with the easiest thing, and you're probably all sick of hearing it, but just we'll do it. You know, what are the symptoms of COVID-19 infection? Generally reported, it's the fever, which is being defined now in all the guidance I'm seeing as 100.4 or above that. Shortness of breath or cough, and then some are starting to also list, we're seeing sore throat among the symptoms. Regarding communications within your facility about COVID-19 with your staff, it's recommended that you designate a point person on these issues and on staff illness and infection issues. It would make sense for that to be a clinical person. The infection control nurse is a great person in that kind of a role. Although if he or she is not already, they may be inundated with other responsibilities in the coming days. And so, you know, a DON, an ADON, somebody who's the designated point person that employees and staff members can contact to report symptoms, to call off and things like that, and kind of have a dual call off, you know, somebody who's calling off for normal health care reasons, follow your normal procedure, somebody who's calling off for COVID-19 related reasons, contact your point person, and those folks may then would be a point person with your public health officials if necessary. What methods of communication? I think it's important that whoever serves in that role be available, and that could be difficult at times right now, and even more so in the coming weeks, but that's, I think, important to have that person, their cell phone be available, their email be available and easy to reach. And I would also encourage you all as an HR function to make sure that you have current and workable contact information for all your staff so that you can reach them in a case of emergency. If you haven't updated phone and email list for a long time, would encourage you to do that so you can effectively communicate with staff members in an emergency. General precautions, quickly, because we've all heard it, hand washing, rigorous hand washing, at least 20 seconds, sing whatever song you need to on a regular basis, or if that's not practical, alcohol-based hand sanitizers, at least, you know, the appropriate strength is being recommended. Coughing etiquette, you know, we should be reminding everyone of coughing etiquette, social distancing, you know, covering cough in a tissue and throwing it away or in your sleeve or something like that, and then also reminding people and encouraging people if they cough or sneeze in their hands to immediately wash. Communicating with employees, the CDC is recommending posters, particularly at points of entry, and this isn't so much an employment issue, but CMS, Centers for Medicaid Services, CMS is wanting people, you to provide spaces right upon entry if possible where people can either wash or use alcohol-based programs or products. So, you know, signs, reminders at that place and around the facility. CDC has a Cover Your Cough poster, and I don't think I mentioned yet. At the end of the materials, there is some resources and links, and I did include a link to the CDC's Cover Your Cough poster that you could use or something like that, just to remind everybody that, you know, now more than ever, and obviously infection control has always been important in healthcare settings, but now even more so, obviously. So the next general area of topics to talk about is just in infection control and access control. You know, should employees work if they're feeling symptoms or exhibiting symptoms of COVID-19? The answer is definitively no. I certainly hope everyone's on board with that without hearing it from me. Employees need to be encouraged to self-isolate if they're feeling any symptoms and refrain from working or coming to the facility at all. And be encouraged to seek medical attention if necessary. I'm going to talk in a little bit here about, you know, going to doctor and returning to work without going to a doctor. But always, you know, if your employees are ill, they should, you know, take care of themselves. And, you know, while some folks are you know, discouraging people from going to the doctors in the sense that we don't want to overburden the system and that's expected to get worse, you know, your employees should always be reminded that, you know, if they're becoming very ill and if they're getting worse, they should get attention. So should we screen our employees? I've got a number of bullet points here for various sources of information on this. When we first started doing this, there was some variance on this, but it seems to be that at least from CMS perspective and ODH is borrowing from that, we are converging on the consensus answer is yes, of course, in the healthcare setting. The CMS guidance for nursing homes, and I've linked all of these also in the resources, you know, specifically directs that nursing homes need to screen all staff at the beginning of their shift for fever and respiratory symptoms. That would be actually taking their temperature. And then documenting the absence of any shortness of breath or new or changed coughing symptoms or sore throats. Hospice providers, similar hospice providers, the QSO memo that they have specifically talks about taking, you know, asking questions about travel within the first 14 days or within the, I should say, the last 14 days, travel to, you know, designated countries and exposure to people with COVID-19 symptoms, and, you know, as an additional screening tool. For home health, we're seeing very similar guidance in the QSO memo there. The Department of Developmental Disabilities issued guidance that says, you know, access should be restricted to those personnel who are absolutely necessary for operation, and they need to be screened pursuant to the CDC and CMS guidance. So that, or procedures, I should say, and that takes us right back to, you know, actually physically taking their temperature, observing for shortness of breath, coughing, sore throats, asking those questions and documenting their absence. And then we had a March 13th order from the department, or the director of the Department of Health, that said all homes, which is an expansive definition. They point back to the statutory definition, which includes nursing facilities, includes the assisted living facilities. It says that all homes should follow the guidance that CMS is giving for visitors and staff, which again is, you know, what we've already listed. So active screening employees every time they come to the facility, including taking temperatures. Should we screen others providing services to the resident? The answer to that is yes, in much the same way. And we want to be limiting service providers to just those that are necessary. And obviously, and I'm not here to talk about visitors, but there are restrictions, severe restrictions on visitation. But regarding employees and those providing services to your residents, absolutely you want to screen. What should you do if an employee becomes ill at work or starts exhibiting symptoms? They should immediately don a face mask, and we'll talk a little bit here in a minute about the shortage of those, and be isolated from residents and other staff. Anybody who deals with them should use PPE for their protection, obviously, and they should be reported to that point person we talked about before. The employee should go home immediately, and they should be quarantined as appropriate or receive medical attention as appropriate based on their risk level. We'll talk about that in a minute as well. Is screening allowed under the Americans with Disabilities Act? Under the circumstances, yes, it is. And this is some advice that's changed a little bit in the last week as this becomes more serious. Generally speaking, under the ADA, employers are not allowed to do medical tests, and taking an employee's temperature is a medical test, are not allowed to screen or do medical tests, but with the current situation, you can, and there's really two reasons for that, if any of your employees object, and I hope they won't, but so you can explain your position. I mean, first, under the ADA, disability-related inquiries or medical testing are allowed if you have a reasonable belief based upon objective evidence that that employee might pose a risk to himself or herself or others. Under the current circumstances with this outbreak being what it is, if you see someone who's exhibiting symptoms, you absolutely can and do that. And then the other side of that is there is EEOC guidance that says in a pandemic situation, you can. It specifically says you can take tests. And I think it's important also to keep in mind, again, just as the ultimate trump card here, we're all looking to guidance from CMS and other healthcare authorities, and we have unequivocally, those of you in you know that are in facility-based, I suspect we may have some home office or headquarters people on here, but certainly facility-based, you have specifically been directed that you must do these screenings. So ADA should not be a concern. Are employees infected with COVID-19 disabled? There's no definitive guidance on this. Generally speaking, ADA is for longer-term or permanent conditions, not short-term illnesses or transitory conditions. So, you know, I think it's too early, certainly, to say that it is a disability. Now, based on someone's particular facts, it could become that way. And then also just always be aware that under both state and federal law, to if you regard someone as disabled, those folks are protected. So if you as an organization, you know, treat or discriminate against someone based upon infection, now there's obvious things that you should do and to protect yourself, your residents, but as far as discrimination, if somebody, you know, was infected by COVID-19, they cleared and can make it through the return to work precautions that we're going to discuss in a minute, and you still fired them or something because of their prior infection, then you might find yourself in a regarded as disabled situation. So you're going to want to take into consideration the requirements on and procedures for returning someone from work. Just on points of access to the facility, everyone is being encouraged to limit the number of points of access to the building, if possible, to one. Obviously, you'll have emergency entrances and exits that you might have, but generally have traffic flow through one location. At that location, as I mentioned earlier, have the ability to wash hands or otherwise sanitize, and, you know, with posters and everything to remind people of that. I see a typo on my copy. Hopefully it got fixed. What if we run out of PPE? That's obviously a very real concern. I know there's already provisions being put into effect to try to, you know, limit the use, but it's a very real concern. Surveyors have been directed to not site for not having certain supplies. Respirators obviously is a big one, but others, if the facility is unable to get them in spite of their best efforts and for reasons outside of their control, you know, you would be encouraged to still keep trying to get them. According to CMS, if you can't get them, somebody should notify the local and state public health agency to let them know that you're having trouble and can't get them. And then CMS is providing guidance on steps to try to advise the next best level of care, which would be beyond the scope of the employment-related issues here. Next, I want to talk about attendance control leave. This is, frankly, the one that already is causing the most questions, and I think a lot of folks are looking into the future weeks, days and weeks, and thinking it's going to be a lot more, and is a big concern. Not to belabor the point, no, people should not work if they are showing symptoms. Next question is, what should we do about our regular attendance and absenteeism policies? I want to a certain extent, break this up a little bit into two answers, because as I said before, I suspect we have some people here who are home office people or support people that are not actually in facilities. We might have a different set of thoughts for those folks as compared to actual healthcare personnel that are providing hands-on service. CDC is recommending that employers be flexible in connection with attendance and absenteeism. Two main reasons they're encouraging that. First of which is that we obviously want people to self-isolate if they're feeling any symptoms. We want to avoid anything that's going to cause people to feel that pressure to come to work. For folks who have a no-fault attendance policy that's purely occurrence-based, if you have, you know, for example, if you have 10 occurrences, you know, it doesn't matter what they're for, once you hit that 10th one, you're done and you're going to get fired. That kind of a policy where you're going to have a punitive effect for the next absence, strongly recommend, and CDC is obviously recommending that you relax that, because you don't want that person to come to work when they shouldn't due to symptoms in order to avoid losing their job. You want that person to be comfortable staying home and be comfortable in his or her job. Avoid punitive measures and do that. The next reason that they're encouraging flexibility, and this is an area we're getting a lot of questions on and working with a lot of our clients on, is it's anticipated that in the coming days and weeks, the, you know, people ill due to COVID-19 infection is going to become a massive burden on our healthcare system. And we're going to want to, when we are dealing with folks who miss work because they've got a fever or other symptoms of this, which, as we all know, are not uncommon, uncommon symptoms for any number of illnesses, including the flu or even common cold. We don't want to burden the system by forcing every single person to go to a doctor who may already be overburdened dealing with people who are legitimately infected. So that's why they're urging some flexibility here. So can we require or should we require people to bring a doctor's note if to return to work? Because of that burden, excuse me, and I am painfully aware of every time I cough lately, so that's one. Hopefully that's not too many. That was more of a clearing my throat. The CDC is encouraging us to relax the standard of requiring a note to come back. Now, I would point out that that's not specifically relating to healthcare personnel who have confirmed cases or who have, and I'm just going to put quotes around it, suspected COVID-19. There's some specific procedures to those, but in order to avoid burdening the healthcare system, employers are being encouraged to not necessarily require a visit to the doctor in every case. So how do we protect ourselves, our residents, our patients, if we're not going to make them go to the doctor and get a clear return to work slip? You know, as a preliminary matter, at a minimum, anybody who misses work due to any symptoms should be screened carefully upon return to work, and obviously we're screening everybody that comes back to work. And one of the things we've worked on with our clients and have prepared is essentially a certification to have the employee complete upon return to work, that in addition to the screening, which is, you know, indicating the reason that they stayed home, indicating what symptoms they experienced that caused them to stay home, and obviously the focus is on the COVID-19 symptoms, the date and the time that they last experienced those symptoms. So you're going to want them to document that, and you know, again, avoiding, you know, actual infection or suspected cases, which we'll talk about now. You're going to want at least 24 hours past any symptom, and important to remember for all these cases, when assessing whether someone has a fever, we're assessing it without any fever-reducing medications that might mask a fever. So you want, as I said, you know, statement what the symptoms are, the date and time they last experienced symptoms, have them certify that, to their knowledge, they haven't been in contact with anybody with COVID-19 in the past 14 days, have them certify that they haven't been to any of those level 3 countries in the last 14 days, and if they can satisfy all of those things and sign that certification, we believe satisfy the requirement that you've got someone who should be safe to return to your workforce. That would be what I would call, frankly, you know, a more aggressive approach. You know, the reality of our situation that we find ourselves in now, and I should probably discuss this briefly right now, is we don't know what we're going to be looking at 2 days from now, 2 weeks from now, or a month from now, and what our situation is. And these are going to be fluid. If we have no staffing shortages, and we've got enough staff to satisfy our residents' needs, and it's going to depend on the acuity level of your residents, you know, that's one thing. If you're in a severe staffing shortage, and I know OHCA and others are working with the governor and trying to get special, you know, provisions and permissions to help with staffing issues. But, you know, as we decide how aggressive or we want to be in getting people back to work, we're going to have to consider all those things, and you're going to have to get your ops people, you're going to have to get your clinical people, and yes, I think you're going to probably want to get your lawyers involved and make assessments based on what you're going to require for someone to come back to work based upon the facts on the ground with respect to your residents and your staff at the time. So that is one level in light of the CDC's recommendation that you not require a doctor's note. I think that's one approach to do it is to get that careful screening and certification where your employee says, no, I didn't go to a doctor, but here's all the information and I have been symptom free for 24 hours now. That would be part of an interview coming back in, too. And if what we find out is someone really had really bad symptoms and was knocked out for days, you know, maybe we're more cautious than somebody who woke up yesterday morning, had a fever of 100.7, it went away, and they've been fine. You know, there's going to be lots of variances here on risk level and risk tolerance based upon the situation that exists at the time. But that would seem to be an approach to deal with the CDC recommendation you not require a doctor's note. So what do we do? The more conservative approach and the obviously if somebody has been infected with COVID-19 or is, quote, suspected of COVID-19, what do we do? The CDC has some guidance on this. One of the challenges, I think, to me is there is no specific definition of what, quote, suspected of having COVID-19 is. You know, if we are going to, if people are going to interpret it, and tomorrow CDC may tell us to interpret it this way, but if people are going to interpret suspected of COVID-19 as any symptom, then everything we said in the last few minutes, this procedure would apply. We're not being mandated to do that. So if somebody has been confirmed to have COVID-19 or is suspected of COVID-19, there are two methods to get back to work. One is the testing-based method. What that is fever is resolved without any fever-reducing meds, an improvement of respiratory symptoms, that's not an elimination improvement, and two negative tests on specimens that were collected more than 24 hours apart. Those folks can come back to work with some precautions. Non-tested based approach is, and so this would be somebody who has not seen a doctor necessarily, employees confirmed if they have COVID-19 or suspected at least 3 days, 72 hours since the resolution of the fever, and improvement of respiratory symptoms, and at least 7 days since the symptoms first onset. So that would be without even seeing a doctor, documenting that could return. With the following precautions, employee needs to wear a face mask at all times in the building for until the symptoms are completely resolved or until 14 days since first symptoms, whichever is longer. Employee should be restricted from contact with severely immunocompromised residents or patients. Good hygiene practices should be followed, and the employee should continuously self-monitor and report and seek reevaluation if symptoms return or worsen. And then the CDC also has a provision in there that certain occupational health folks could accelerate this in severe shortages and issues. So, but generally speaking, that's the rule. Guidance for isolating employees exposed to individuals infected. The CDC has actually prepared a really helpful chart. I linked to it in the materials for exactly what types of restrictions and for how long someone should take based upon exposure. It's very clear on, you know, the type of exposure and the type of PPE in place. So that's available. Won't try to go through it all. I'm looking at the time and seeing it, so I am trying to move forward. I'm sorry if this is going longer than I expected, but I will continue moving. Are employees who miss work covered by FMLA due to COVID-19? I think clearly COVID-19 illness is a serious health condition under FMLA. So if somebody is otherwise eligible for FMLA, this clearly would be covered because if they have it or to care for someone who has it. Although I warn you that this is specifically and squarely in the middle of the issues that are being addressed by the federal legislation, the Families First Coronavirus Response Act. I'm going to talk about just generally below here in a few minutes, but this may change significantly based upon the passage of this act, but clearly an employee's own infection or to care for someone with an infection is covered, and if they've been there for at least a year and have worked 1,250 hours, they're going to be entitled to FMLA leave. Can they refuse to come to work because they're afraid of contracting? Generally speaking and technically, no. OSHA does have a provision where employees can refuse to work if they believe they're in an imminent danger of death or serious injury. I don't think, and I haven't seen any interpretation to suggest that this would generally apply in this situation. It's not quite so imminent and immediate. However, I do think that there would be a risk there if employees were being asked to work around COVID patients without PPE. If they refused under those circumstances, arguably you would get there. But again, this is another area where I think the situation is very fluid, and looking down the road, if we have severe staffing shortages and severe PPE shortages, we would have to, everyone should revisit that with their ops people and look for additional guidance. So paid time off. Do we have to pay for time missed because of outbreak? At the present time, as of today, and we'll talk about the new proposed law here in a minute, there is no specific legal requirement that employees missing work be paid. You should look to your own PTO policies and sick leave policies. I think this falls into the category, and again, trying to discourage people from coming to work with illnesses, where you might want to be flexible if you have a sick leave policy that doesn't cover the first day. You know, they have to be at least 3 days before they get sick leave, or if you have a policy that requires a doctor's notice, we talked about before, you know, various other things, maybe be a little flexible in that to try to get employees to be able to use their PTO and do it. One question we have seen, and I know was submitted on this, is if you require somebody to stay home, do you have to give them PTO? And again, you know, your policy ultimately says what it says, and you have to do what your policy says. That might be an area, again, where you may want to make some exception to your policy. And even if they're not symptomatic, if you're forcing them to stay home, I think you would certainly want to at least consider allowing your policy. We've also worked with clients to create a document that kind of outlines some of the changes to attendance and sick policy that we're doing. So some flexibility there would be helpful, and then this is also going to be addressed in the new law. Can we withhold pay from exempt employees for absences? I think here we fall under the general Fair Labor Standards Act law. Exempt employees can be charged for partial day absences. You can make them take PTO. There's nothing wrong with that. And use their PTO. Really what FLSA focuses on is when you're actually reducing pay, so not giving them PTO. If you have an exempt employee who has used all of his or her PTO that he's entitled to or she's entitled to and still needs more time off under the FLSA, you can then withhold pay for full days or more. So no half days, never withhold pay for half days, but if they've exhausted everything, and there's nothing more available under your policies, you could withhold pay from exempt employees because of their absences for multiples of full day. Unemployment comp, is there anything being done to help employees get it? The answer is yes. Governor DeWine is issued an executive order making it easier for employees to receive unemployment during this. Benefits will be available from day one for people who are who are requesting medical or people who are quarantined, they would be able to get it. Laid off employees will be eligible. Asymptomatic employees who self-impose quarantine typically will not be available. So that gets back to people who you know, we all, I'm sure, are seeing people who are very afraid and just want to self-isolate for their protection, and that wouldn't be covered. Child care. This is very new. Obviously, schools are closed. The governor has been signaling that daycare may be closed. Just yesterday, late in the day, the director of ODJFS signed an order authorizing emergency pandemic child care licenses to be granted for people that would be providing child care to health care professionals, people working in health care. Either existing facilities could get those special licenses as an exception to the order if the governor closes them down, or setting up your own. So more information is going to be coming. That just happened last night, but the expectation is clearly they're intending to make provisions for health care workers to be able to have child care for their kids so that they can keep coming to work. Privacy, if you have an employee who's sick and you're investigating an employee who's sick, they're entitled to some privacy. So don't disclose the identity of your employees who become ill or who get infected. Labor law issues, just go through quickly. Can you discipline employees for complaining, for raising issues about safety and things like that? And just, it's the general provision under the Fair Labor Standards Act. Employees are entitled to engage in protected concerted activity. So two or more employees coming together discussing or complaining about or raising questions or concerns about safety, about how many hours of overtime they're working if we get to that point, about staffing, about all of those things, that's protected activity, and they shouldn't be disciplined for that. That's true whether you have a union in your building or not. Can you just make changes without discussing with your union? If you do have a union, the answer there is no. You are going to want to talk with the union, and depending on, you know, again, fluid situation, depending on how urgent and emergent the situations become, you know, how much time you've got to give and how much notice and how much you have to do with the union is going to vary, but you should communicate with your union before you make changes. Although, do look at your bargaining agreement. Many collective bargaining agreements do have management rights provisions that allow you to adjust staffing and hours and things like that, and, you know, if you've got those rights in your contract, then you can use them. If you get union information requests, and I do know that unions are asking questions about availability of PPE and various other safety things, and unfortunately that is something that, you know, it arguably would be a unfair labor practice to not answer those kinds of questions. So yeah, you should do your best to try to respond to a union information request, even, you know, and they may not be happy, but even if respond at least to say we can't respond right now and give them kind of a time frame for response. Don't just ignore them. So let's talk about the federal law here real quick, just kind of as a closing thing to talk about. The Families First Coronavirus Response Act was passed through the House, was recently amended. I am not aware what exactly is going on with the Senate, but we're going to see some version of this kind of law, I would suspect, here pretty soon. And so what it does is, first of all, on FMLA, in broad categories, it does two things primarily from an employment perspective that we're going to focus on. First of all, it amends FMLA to make it to add an additional reason people can take FMLA relating to their children's school closing or daycare closing. And their need to be home and care for children. That becomes a new reason for FMLA leave. The traditional 12 weeks of leave. Importantly, in that regard, as I said earlier, usually you have to be employed for 12 months in order to be eligible for FMLA. It is defining that back down to just 30 days, so much newer employees would be eligible for FMLA. And they could take that to care for sons and daughters. Hopefully, we'll get some relief on that, on the child care that I mentioned earlier. So that's item number one as far as just granting additional leave, and now we still have a 12-week limit. Eligible employees who take more than 10 days of FMLA leave for these public health emergencies, so dealing with the kids, would be entitled to compensation of two-thirds of the, and this is, I should clarify, this is after the first 10 days. I'm not sure I mentioned that. So after they're out 10 days, they could get paid for the remainder of the 12 weeks of two-thirds of their usual rate of pay with a cap of $200 a day and $10,000 in the aggregate per employee for those additional paid leaves. The first 10 days don't have to be leave, the first 10 days don't have to be paid for reasons I'll explain in just a second, but the employee can choose to use PTO during that time. So if you have a PTO policy and they could get full pay under PTO for those first 2 weeks, they can choose to do that if they wish to. And contrary to typically under FMLA, you can't as an employer require them to use PTO in the first 10 days. Traditionally under FMLA, employers could require employees to burn PTO. That has changed. The Secretary of Labor will have the authority, as this is written now, to issue regulations that would exclude certain health care providers and emergency responders from this new definition. That hasn't happened yet. I know that OHCA and others are really pushing for that so that none of this would apply to our staff, but I still think it's worthwhile to tell you what this law is in case either the Department of Labor doesn't do that or in the meantime in case this gets enacted. So the second half of this, in addition to the FMLA expansions, is just a paid leave provision in here. The law would provide paid leave for up to 2 weeks, and now this would be the first 2 weeks. So this would cover that first 10 days, up to 2 weeks in addition to PTO offered by an employer, and it would apply before the PTO offered by the employer for employees who are quarantined, employees who are advised by their health care to self-quarantine due to concerns related to COVID-19, and I note that that doesn't say because of symptoms, it just says because of concerns, so that sounds kind of like it's getting more towards someone who's afraid of being infected if their doctor says they should self-quarantine, so maybe, you know, immunocompromised people who on the advice of their doctor stay home. Employee has symptoms of COVID-19 seeking diagnosis. Those are the first three reasons. The next three reasons are employees caring for someone who's quarantined or has been advised to self-quarantine, or an employee who is caring for a son or daughter out of school or child care. And then the last one is kind of a catch-all, any substantially similar condition that gets specified down the road from the HHS, DOL, or Treasury. So the pay for these folks would be how much and what the caps are depends upon the reason. Those first three bullet points, their own quarantine, their doctor recommending it, or their own illness would be full pay for a max of $511 a day or $5,100 total. The latter three, so really caring for other people, would be two-thirds pay for a max of $200 a day, $2,000 total. This is all going to be offset. The intention is it's all offset by dollar-for-dollar payroll taxes. That will be how that will get paid for. Employers will not be allowed to change their PTO plans in advance of this. Couldn't require employees to find their own replacements in order to be eligible for this. And it would be available to employees no matter how long they've been employed. So this would even apply to new employees. So there is some thought out there that nursing facilities are going to be hiring folks, you know, who are being displaced from other things. And I know OHCA and others are trying to get some, you know, some easing on some of the requirements for those staff. But those brand new employees would be entitled to this. Failing to comply with this would be a wage and hour violation. It's essentially a failure to provide minimum wage. And if this does get signed, it'll go into effect 15 days after signed. So that's the conclusion of the materials that I prepared. The two other questions that I really briefly want to touch on that I got that I don't think we touched on. I understand there's some concerns about BCI checks and local offices shutting down, and unfortunately this categorized as one of those fluid situations. I don't have a good answer for that, although I do note that for new employees, you know, there has always been a provision of people are allowed to work up to 30 days, you know, as long as you actually take the prints and send them out. So that is one thought. I don't know if anybody is pushing for any exceptions or exceptions to that. I think this is another situation that's going to depend largely on how acute things get in the coming days. And another was travel within the United States to and from areas that may be more affected. I have seen nothing at all suggesting any guidance on that. Obviously, there's quarantines and precautions for people who fly to and from, or I should say, from certain countries, the level 3 countries that have been identified. I've seen nothing suggesting any specific precaution is recommended I haven't even seen recommended and certainly not required for travel within the United States. So that brings me to the end of the materials. I really hope this was helpful. Things are changing quickly, and we will continue to be monitoring it. We're happy. We hope everyone, as you confront these issues, seek guidance of your counsel, whoever that might be, and we'll keep monitoring the developments with various agencies that are issuing guidance. So thank you very much for your time. Good luck. Wash your hands and stay safe.
Thank you, Rob, and thank you, everybody, for joining us. As Rob said at the beginning of the call, this was a recorded call, and we will post that online as soon as we have that recording available. So thank you for your time.
Thanks, Mandy.